Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, and let's see. Oh, the date. It's April 15th. Why could I forget today's date? So anyway, I'd like to thank all of you for paying your taxes. That's very nice. Anybody thank you? No one's thanked me yet today, but I thought I'd thank you. We're supposed to have a test next week, and on the schedule it says chapters 13 and 14, but we're not going to cover 14. So I think the test is just going to cover 13 and 14, not 14 and 15, right? 12 and 13, I'm sorry, 12 and 13, muscle and blood, 12 and 13 and not 14, yeah. So we'll probably start talking about 14 maybe today, I'm not sure, but for sure next week, because your test is on Wednesday, All right, so that's the best that I can see at the moment. But don't rush out of class. I'll update you guys right as we leave class, too, if we keep the same plan. So right now the plan is what? 12 and 13. Okay? All right. So we were talking about blood groups last time and blood typing. And what happens if somebody gets the wrong blood type, if somebody's transfused with the wrong blood type? What happens there? What do we call that? Yes, okay, it's called a transfusion reaction, but the best way to think about it and to talk about it is agglutination. And could you describe what agglutination really means? What's happening when something agglutinates? What kind of reaction is it? What's happening there? Hemolysis, eventually it will result in hemolysis. The red blood cells will clump together and they will hemolyze. But why is it? How is it that they clump together? That's the key that I want you to think of. When you think of agglutination, think of an antibody antigen reaction. All right, and then if you have that in mind, then you should know where the antibodies are located and where the antigens are located. Where are antigens located? On the cell membranes of the red blood cells, right? And the antibodies are located in the plasma. They're located in the plasma. They're soluble proteins in plasma. And don't forget, antibodies have two receptor sites, and so one receptor can bind one cell and the other receptor site can bind another cell, in which case, and they're kind of like glued together. And antibodies can bind thousands or even millions of red blood cells together and cause them to precipitate out of solution, form a big crystal, and then they're going to hemolyze, which means explode. Okay, so agglutination is an antibody-antigen reaction. And that's one of the immune functions of the blood. Okay, well, we're going to switch topics now and talk about another function of blood, and that is, how does blood prevent blood loss? Because blood is a fluid kind of connective tissue, and as soon as you put a hole in a blood vessel, blood is going to leak out of it. And if it's a high-pressure vessel, like what kind of vessel is high pressure? An artery, then blood is just kind of squirting out. Okay, so how does blood protect itself from leaving blood vessels? And that process is not agglutination. It's called blood clotting, but it's got a more proper term, and it's called coagulation. So the two words I want you to be familiar with is coagulation and agglutination, and what is the big difference between them. So we're going to start talking about that process by which you stop blood loss, and that's called hemostasis. Maintaining blood volume is hemostasis, preventing hemorrhaging, and that process is agglutination. All right, so that's actually the next slide right here. So hemostasis is cessation of bleeding when a blood vessel is damaged. All right, we can break hemostasis down into two kinds of processes. One process is good for very small kinds of microvascular tears, so things that you can't see with your naked eye, right? And that would be a platelet plug formation. That's for very, very small tears. And the second process is going to be for larger tears. When a gross vessel, that means what, large vessel gets damaged and there's a large blood loss, and that is fibrin formation. All right, so fibrin formation is the same thing as coagulation, that is for large tears. All right, that plugs and plug and surroundings, or the plug that's formed by these platelets right here, are infiltrated by a web of this protein that we call fibrin, forming a clot, a blood clot. And you're kind of familiar with what a blood clot looks like. So let me talk about platelet plug formation first, and then go on to coagulation. All right, so remember, what are the two compartments in blood? How could you break blood down into two places? You got plasma and you got formed elements. All right, and so where does platelet belong in that scheme of things? It's a formed element, right? It's a very, very small formed element. Remember, it doesn't have any organelles, doesn't have a nucleus, but it's loaded with chemicals to prevent blood loss. All right, so when we have a healthy blood vessel like we have right here, we see blood vessels. And actually, I don't even see any platelets in this illustration because they're so small. But in this particular case, if a blood vessel is healthy, here is the endothelium, right? That's just the epithelium that's lining a blood vessel. It's intact. It hasn't been cut or anything. These cells are releasing nitric oxide and a prostaglandin called prostacyclin. And these chemical compounds right here keep the blood vessel dilated, and it also prevents platelets from sticking together. And there is another compound that's going to activate platelets so that they start to stick together, and that is ADP. So if ADP is present, platelets are going to start to clump together. So there are compounds within the endothelium right here that break down any ADP that seems to be floating around into AMP, right, metabolizing it, getting it out of the way right away so that platelet aggregation does not happen. So this is in a normal blood vessel. Right, so platelets don't form in normal blood vessels under normal circumstances. It can happen under pathological conditions. And you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? That would be a really bad thing, right? If you have normal vasculature without any tears or rips, without any hemorrhage, the last thing you want to have happen to the blood is to have it start to coagulate. And that does happen in some patients, and it's really unfortunate when that happens. It's very difficult to treat. Okay, so then underneath the epithelium, we see, for instance, like collagen fibers, right? That's just a fiber in connective tissue. And associated with collagen fibers are other kinds of molecules that we call the von Willebrand factor. I'll tell you what that's for in just a second. Okay, so these, the collagen and the von Willebrand factor, is not in contact with the blood. But guess what happens if you injure this blood vessel right here? What does that reveal to the blood? Or what can the blood touch? Platelets can come in contact with the collagen and the von Willebrand factor, and a platelet plug starts to form. All right, so here we can see that the integrity of the endothelium has been destroyed, and you see the underlying connective tissue. Platelets are flowing by the site, and they bump into the von Willebrand factor and the platelets, and they start to stick together. And basically, they just kind of pave over this area of injury, right? And when they start to become activated, they release some compounds, namely what? ADP, and also thromboxane A2. We're just going to call that TXA2. These are chemicals that are going to attract other platelets to this area right here and cause them to become sticky. Right, and when all these platelets are sticky, that just forms a nice platelet plug over this area right here. All right, platelets also release some serotonin, which causes vasoconstriction of this area, which then also inhibits bleeding from this site right here. So when these platelets get activated, when they contact collagen and the von Willebrand's factor, we call that the platelet release reaction when they become activated. Okay, and aspirin can act as an anticoagulant, and because aspirin blocks the synthesis of prostaglandins, like the TXA2, right? So if you inhibit the production of TXA2, then you inhibit this, platelet release reaction, and that inhibits clot formation, or at least platelet plug formation. Okay, so that's one of the, so aspirin will block any kind of prostaglandin synthesis. All right, so here we see a platelet plug. The vessel becomes vasoconstricted. and then bleeding is stopped from this site right here. All right, so this is for very small kinds of vascular wounds. And if it's a larger kind of tear, right, then the platelet plug becomes infiltrated by a meshwork of fibrin. And fibrin is a protein. All right, so now the clot contains platelets and fibrin. And since fibrin acts like a net, as blood starts to flow through that network of fibrin, it also traps red blood cells, it traps white blood cells, and it even traps plasma to some degree. All right, and when it traps all of these formed elements in plasma, then that forms a blood clot. All right, and because of serotonin, all right, then and the release of this fibrin, this meshwork over the plug contracts to form a compact plug over the wound. All right, so for coagulation, we want to convert something called fibrinogen into fibrin. And I'm not sure I've gone over this nomenclature with you before, but if you see a word that has the suffix on the end of it, ogen, then you should always know that it is an inactive form of a molecule. Okay, so this is a protein, so fibrinogen is a protein, but it's in an inactive form, and it can be converted into fibrin in a moment's notice. So fibrinogen acts like a reservoir for fibrin. And this is really important because fibrin is going to cause hemostasis for a large vascular injury, right, where you need a lot of fibrin formation, but it's a protein. So for instance, if you cut yourself and you start to hemorrhage, it might take a day or two or three or maybe even a week to build enough fibrin up in order to seal that site of injury closed. All right, but do you have that period of time to wait? Okay, when you're hemorrhaging, you don't. So what has evolved in our bodies is a system that produces this precursor, this inactive form of fibrin. So you have a huge reservoir of this precursor, namely fibrinogen, which can be converted into fibrin in just a moment's notice whenever there is injury to a blood vessel. So you don't have to wait days in order to stop bleeding. Okay, so there are two pathways that can make fibrin from fibrinogen. And one is called an intrinsic pathway, and the other is called an extrinsic pathway. And the usual pathway that activates blood clot formation is this extrinsic pathway, but I do want to talk a bit about this intrinsic pathway. This can happen, this can form a clot in some damaged blood vessels, or when blood is left, for instance, in a test tube. When you take blood out of somebody and just leave it in a test tube, it's going to clot on its own. And as a matter of fact, any time you take blood and you keep it from flowing, if you keep it just stationary, it's going to have a tendency to form a clot as well. So blood has to flow to stay in a fluid form. So for instance, if someone has a part of their heart, like an atrium that's no longer contracting, blood will flow into that part of their heart and won't flow out quite so quickly. That atrium has a tendency to generate blood clots, which again can be fatal because those clots can go to the heart or to the brain or lung or whatever. Okay, and that is due to this intrinsic pathway. All right, and it's initiated by the exposure of blood to some kind of negatively charged surface, for instance, on glass or blood vessel collagen. And this activates a protease, which activates a series of other clotting factors. And these clotting factors, along with calcium ions and phospholipids, convert an enzyme, which we call thrombin, okay, it activates thrombin. Now we saw in the previous slide that if there is a suffix on the word ogen, that means that it is, what, a precursor and inactive. All right, sometimes if we're dealing with an enzyme, and we kind of bumped into this concept in one of the previous chapters, if we have an enzyme and it is in an inactive form, sometimes we call it, what, a proenzyme. So here we have an enzyme called thrombin, but you see this pro in front of it, that means what? That it is also inactive, right? So prothrombin is inactive, but it's a reservoir to make thrombin in a hurry should there ever be damage to a blood vessel. So if your body didn't make a lot of prothrombin and you had injury to a blood vessel, again, it might take days or a week to clot that blood vessel off, and during that time, certainly you could bleed to death. So fibrinogen is inactive, but a reservoir of fibrin. Prothrombin is inactive, but it is a reservoir of thrombin, which is a necessary enzyme to cause blood clots. Okay? So the main job of thrombin is to convert fibrinogen to fibrin, right? And then when fibrin is formed, that forms that mesh. It precipitates out of solution. That protein falls out of solution and forms a blood clot. This extrinsic pathway right here is usually how coagulation starts in somebody's body. It's activated when there's damage to a blood vessel. And when that tissue is damaged, the tissue releases something called thromboplastin. Thromboplastin is not really an enzyme, but it's a cofactor that allows various enzymes to become activated. And this is a relatively fast, and it's a shortcut compared to the intrinsic pathway. Thromboplastin is not inactive. It is always fully active, but we don't find it in the endothelium. It's in tissue that's underneath the endothelium. So the endothelium has to be disturbed, all right, or cut away from the blood vessel, all right? It just needs that tissue just needs to be exposed in order for tissue thromboplastin to act, and that's going to start the extrinsic pathway. All right, so I want to show you the next slide, which is a scheme of coagulation. It's not an exam figure, and it might look a little, you have it in front of you already, but I'm not showing it to you on the screen right at the moment because it looks intimidating. All right, you don't have to know all the parts for coagulation, but I do want to go over some of the essential features, and probably after I describe some of these essential features, you'll agree with me that it's really nice to know about. Okay, so here is the scheme for coagulation. And what do we see? Here is that extrinsic pathway that I was talking about. All right, this is the usual way that coagulation is initiated. Here is the intrinsic pathway, and you see that they interact with this common pathway. But the bottom line is, when a clot is formed, what is the molecule that's formed? I never want you to lose sight of the important fact right here. Just like, what's the whole purpose of respiration? You learned all kinds of metabolic reactions, but cellular respiration is is there for the production of ATP, right? And you got CO2, and you got oxygen, and electron transport, and all that kind of stuff. Well, here is the scheme for coagulation, but the bottom line is, what is it going to produce? Fibrin, right? And fibrin is insoluble, and it's a net that traps all the formed elements and even some plasma to seal off a blood vessel. Okay. Well, here you can see a number of different steps. Here is thromboplastin, which is in tissue, and it's released whenever tissue is damaged. And thromboplastin then can activate, for instance, factor 7 right here, and then factor 7 can activate factor 10, right? So then factor 10, sometimes we call this instead of factor 7 activated, we would call that factor 7A for activation. This would be factor 10. This would be factor 10A after it becomes activated. All right, so in order to activate these various steps right here in the extrinsic pathway, what do we need? Well, we need thromboplastin, like we said right here, but we also need calcium ions. All right, so here is another important function for calcium ions. You need that for synaptic transmission. You need it for muscle contraction, right? But you also need it for proper clotting function, right? To have the proper levels in your body. And of course, you need it for strong bones, but now that's really kind of, you probably are aware, that's pretty low down on the list to maintain compared to these other important functions in your body. And you also need some phospholipids in order to have proper clotting function. Okay, so factor 10 right here is in the common pathway, and again, you need calcium and phospholipids and some other things. This activated factor 10 can then convert prothrombin into this active form of thrombin, and then what does thrombin do? Thrombin converts fibrinogen into fibrin, and this clotting process now is pretty much complete, and you will stop bleeding. Okay. So this is the usual way that blood will clot. Prothrombin is made by the liver. In order for you to make prothrombin, you need vitamin K. So without proper vitamin K in your diet, you won't have proper clotting function. You'll have a tendency to bleed. And what can you tell me about vitamins in general? Can your body make them?
No,
they can't, or you can't. That's an essential nutrient. You need to have that in your diet. And does anybody know what a good dietary source of vitamin K would be? Yeah, green leafy vegetables. Did I talk about this already? No. Very good that you know that. Okay. And that's very important. I know my nephews, when they were really young, they would horse around a lot, okay, and bump into a coffee table or whatever, and always end up with a nosebleed, like right before dinner, and everybody would be so upset. And I would sit them down and talk about the extrinsic pathway and the extrinsic pathway right here and tell them how important vitamin K is and that they should always eat broccoli, okay? Because green leafy vegetables contain proper amounts of vitamin K, and they would just kind of look at me very politely as blood was dripping out of their nose. But you know what? Do you think they would ever eat broccoli? No, they never would. These guys would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli. So hopefully you're not like that. Okay. So your diet can influence your diet can influence clotting function, and if your clotting function is being guided or manipulated with pharmaceutical agents like Coumadin or whatever, then you should have pretty much a constant diet of green leafy vegetables, including broccoli, so that when the proper therapeutic dose of coumarin has been adjusted for your body, you don't disrupt that adjustment that has been made by the pharmacy. All right, so sometimes that can be a little tricky. All right, so prothrombin gets converted to thrombin, and then thrombin converts a bunch of fibrinogen to fibrin, and then you can stop bleeding. But what is this mechanism here? We see this multi-step mechanism with various enzymes. When thrombin converts fibrinogen to fibrin, what happens to this thrombin? Does it go away?
No.
It's an enzyme. What does it do? It converts more fibrinogen to fibrin. Right, because an enzyme isn't destroyed, it's not used up, only reactants are converted to products. All right, so here's a step. Here's another step, right, with an enzymatically catalyzed reaction. All right, so thromboplastin doesn't get used up, it just what? Activates more factor 7. All right, so what do we call this with multiple steps of enzymatic reactions? Okay, what's going on here? This is really the important, this is why I want you to see this diagram. And we were looking at this in terms of second messenger systems. And I called it a cascade mechanism. So what's the beauty of a cascade mechanism? It's all of these different stages right here act as a step of signal amplification, where a process can happen very quickly. Okay, and so that's really the beauty of this blood clotting system. It's something that can happen very quickly, and fibrinogen, right, is inactive, prothrombin is inactive, but it can be converted into an active form very, very quickly. So I want you to appreciate this from the standpoint of being a cascade. Okay, not that you have to know all the individual steps right here. The other thing I think that's fun to know about is something about vitamin K, and of course it's really important to know something about calcium and how it interacts with clotting function. And if you don't have proper calcium, you'll have decreased clotting function. And as a matter of fact, one way to prevent blood from clotting is to take all calcium out of the plasma that fibrinogen is in. And that's one way that we can preserve blood in a test tube, prevent it from clotting, is to add chemicals that take calcium out of solution. Anybody know what those chemicals are called that can sequester calcium, take them out of solution? It's called EDTA. And it can take other things out like magnesium. All right, so that's the extrinsic pathway. The extrinsic pathway, even though it's a cascade mechanism and with levels of amplification, it usually can't provide the formation of enough fibrin fast enough to prevent blood loss. All right? And that's where the intrinsic pathway comes in. All right? So I want to describe something to you about the intrinsic pathway. All right? Thrombin could also influence, thrombin not only converts fibrinogen to fibrin, but it also influences activity in this intrinsic pathway. It helps convert factor 11 into factor 11A. It activates 11A, which then activates what another cascade mechanism, which then contributes to the common pathway, which then, okay, can we see that this acts in a positive feedback that enhances factor 11A? And then that even makes more factor 10 that becomes activated, which makes more thrombin. And then this more thrombin makes more of these intrinsic pathway factors, which makes what? More thrombin. All right, so here is a nice positive feedback mechanism, but the bottom line, what? You have more and more thrombin making more and more fibrin. Right, so in order to have proper blood clotting function, you really need this positive feedback mechanism within the intrinsic pathway in order to clot fast enough to prevent significant blood loss. And this is the step right here that is inhibited with heparin. And heparin is another anticoagulant that we use sometimes, right? Because it blocks thrombin, and if you block the action of thrombin, right, you block this intrinsic pathway, and then you block the formation of fibrin. Okay, so you can see the cascade mechanisms. You can see a positive feedback loop right here, which makes blood clotting very efficient and very fast. And don't forget about the reservoirs of these important compounds, prothrombin and fibrin, that are always in your blood. Okay, but they're inactive, waiting to go to work. Okay, you might have heard of a disease process where somebody's blood just won't clot. And as a matter of fact, if they get a little paper cut on their finger, okay, they can actually bleed to death. Probably not in the United States because there's proper medical care, but if you maybe are away from where you can get to a hospital, you could bleed to death. And what is that condition called? That's called hemophilia, and that's a genetically inherited disease. And I was going to do a Google to see if how many hemophiliacs or patients with hemophilia are still alive. But most of the patients that I knew with hemophilia died of AIDS, because way back when AIDS was just coming out, we didn't know anything about AIDS. And the way that we treat people with hemophilia is with transfusions for various clotting factors. Okay, and so they were just transfused, unfortunately, with the virus before the medical community knew anything about it. Okay, so patients with hemophilia have no factor 8 right here. And what does that do? If there's no factor 8, okay, that blocks this positive feedback loop, so only the extrinsic pathway can operate, and that does not produce enough fibrin to produce a sufficient blood clot, right? So the intrinsic pathway is definitely necessary. So if I'm going to think about coagulation, I want to break it down maybe into these three main steps right here. So this is probably something, if you're going to memorize anything from this slide right here, are these three main steps, okay? So let's start with the bottom line. What's the bottom line? Fibrin formation, which is what? The conversion of fibrinogen to fibrin. Is that pretty easy to see? That's pretty easy to see. All right, well, how do you make fibrin? Well, it's by thrombin formation, okay? So that converts prothrombin to thrombin, and what does that? Well, that's activated factor 10, and what you should probably call that is prothrombin activator, right? Prothrombin activator formation is really the first step, which is produced by all of these different cascade mechanisms, both the intrinsic and extrinsic pathway. So these are the three steps for coagulation. Okay, so when you think of agglutination, what should you think of? Antibody-antigen reaction, right? These two molecules coming together. What about coagulation? Is it like antibody-antigen reaction at all? No, it's got this cascade mechanism, and you need calcium, and you need all these different clotting factors, right? And it's controlled by tissues, injury to tissues, and it results in the production of this network right here. Looks kind of strange from my angle right here, but probably here you can see some red blood cells. This figure is not in your book, unfortunately. You can see red blood cells. There's probably platelets in there that you can't see, but all of these little yellow fibers right here are fibrin that have precipitated out of solution. What color are these fibers?
Yellow.
Okay. Okay, and that traps blood. This is what forms a blood clot. So coagulation is what? Fibrin formation, right? Fibrin formation. That's really what I want you to know. Okay. And this table right here just shows what the list of these various factors are. And of course, they're not in the proper order of sequence. They're given numbers by when they were discovered or described in the process of coagulation. So, factor number 12 over here might be one of the first, last factors, but it might be involved in one of the first steps of coagulation. All right, so you might be interested in looking at this because, for instance, here's calcium ions, that's factor 4, and then we said factor 8 is that anti-hemophiliac factor. I'm not going to test you on any of this, but it's just kind of fun to look at sometimes if you're interested in knowing something about coagulation. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because, for instance, yeah, if on the surface of your body, well, you can bleed internally and it's going to form a blood clot. But if this is on the surface of your body, okay, then, of course, the water that's in the plasma that's trapped in that blood clot is going to evaporate, and that's going to form a really hard kind of scab. And what color is that? That's red. That's due to all the red blood cells that are trapped right there. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so is there anything else I want to talk about this? No, just look at that cascade mechanism. Look at this positive feedback mechanism. And this, I modified the diagram that's in your book just a little bit, so make sure that you see how I modified this diagram, all right? So it's, I think, maybe a little bit easier to understand. So don't forget, coagulation, three-step process, prothrombin activator formation, then you got thrombin formation, and then fibrin formation, and then you have a blood clot. And this all happens very quickly because of that positive feedback mechanism and cascade working. Plus, don't forget about the reservoir of these compounds, right? Fibrinogen and prothrombin. And all the clotting factors also are there in your blood ready to be activated at a moment's notice as well. And a lot of these clotting factors are produced in the liver. So if somebody has liver disease, guess what happens to somebody's clotting function? It's decreased dramatically, okay? Okay, and then they need transfusions maybe of platelets or whatever. Okay, so commonly in everyday language, if somebody is taking anticoagulation therapy, maybe due to Coumarin or heparin or whatever, or aspirin, right? People just in the general public, how do they talk about anticoagulation therapy? They talk about it in terms of blood thinners, okay? And that's really interesting, but somebody that's sort of educated, they kind of cringe because if you're going to inhibit the formation of fibrin, do you see anything that we're diluting the blood with here? No, so we're not really diluting somebody's blood, right? We're just interrupting a cascade mechanism or some kind of positive feedback mechanism. We're not diluting somebody's blood out. So somebody that has anticoagulation therapy, their blood is what? It's as concentrated as anybody else's blood. So we're changing this active mechanism. We're adjusting this mechanism right here. But you could go ahead and say blood thinner because almost everybody in the world would know what you're talking about, right? Unless you're talking to somebody in the medical community. Okay. So please really appreciate the difference between agglutination and coagulation, even though they sound kind of similar. Okay. Well, there has to be things that limit blood that limit coagulation. So, for instance, if you get a cut on your finger, where would you like to have that blood clot? Maybe right there on your finger right there where you're bleeding from. You don't want that blood clot to move up your finger into your arm and then into your chest, right, and then your head because, well, that would be the end of the story. So there has to be antagonistic control over coagulation. And so let's talk about how a blood clot, the extent of a blood clot formation is how it's controlled. All right, and even how a blood clot is dissolved after a tissue is repaired. All right, so these things work together. So when damage is repaired, activated factor 12 causes the activation of kallikrein. And kallikrein is an enzyme that converts plasminogen. And what can you tell me about plasminogen? It's inactive. and it's waiting for a signal. Your body's got, you know, hundreds of thousands of these molecules ready and waiting to go to work, and it gets converted to plasmin. And the job of plasmin is to digest fibrin. So it can limit the extent of clot formation so that you have a blood clot only where you need it in your body. But this also gets rid of blood clots when, for instance, you don't need to have it there anymore. Okay.
So is it a macrophage?
It's an enzyme. Plasmin is an enzyme. All right. Whoop. I went too far. That is just going to break these chemical bonds, okay, in the fibrin molecule. So it's going to dissolve fibrin, and then the blood clot is going to be dissolved. And clinically, that's pretty important because sometimes maybe somebody has a blood clot, and if it can be diagnosed properly in the brain, blood is not getting to the brain, and there is a compound called tissue plasminogen activator. We call it TPA. And if somebody is having a stroke due to a blood clot in the brain, somebody can get an injection of TPA that activates plasmin, and plasmin dissolves the blood clot, and blood flow is restored to the brain, and what happens to the stroke? Well, it erases the stroke just magically like that, okay? But, of course, you have to be around some pretty sophisticated physicians and equipment to make sure that somebody's having a stroke because of a blood clot and not a tear in a blood vessel. Right, because if it's a tear in a blood vessel and you inhibit blood clotting, what do? Oh, you make it a million times worse, right? So you have to be pretty sophisticated to use this stuff. But it's like a miracle drug if you know when and how to use it properly, right? There's also an enzyme that's produced by a bacteria called streptokinase, and it has the same kind of function as plasmin. It can also be used to digest blood clots. Oh, that does remind me of something. So when somebody is having a stroke, okay, a lot of times, and I would be like this, I'm sure, too, I would like to not recognize those symptoms and say, oh, well, it will pass, it will go away, don't worry about it, you know, even though I might not be able to talk to my family or whatever, and this might be, you know, your grandma or grandpa or whatever, or maybe they'll just have a little ischemic attack and be non-responsive, okay? But when is it, when should they go to the hospital? How should we treat patients like that? Aggressively, right. I would say immediately, right? Because if you take them to a really sophisticated hospital like Memorial or something, they'll be able to perform these tests, and this revascularization therapy you have to institute right away. You can't just let it linger. So don't pretend like the symptoms aren't happening. Get to the hospital as soon as possible, okay, for proper treatment. Okay. Anticoagulants, we talked a little bit already about this. Calcium is necessary for proper clotting function. In a test tube, we can give EDTA or sodium citrate. We can't inject these compounds into people. Why can't we inject EDTA into somebody? What's it going to do? Well, it's going to bind up calcium that's in the plasma. What do you need plasma calcium for? Synaptic transmission, muscle contraction, right? So you just automatically are going to kill somebody. But you can prevent blood from clotting in a test tube, and a lot of times you want to keep blood in a nice fluid form, and you can use these compounds. Okay, so heparin activates antithrombin that blocks thrombin formation. Coumarin blocks clotting function by inhibiting activation of vitamin K, and vitamin K also works via calcium. Okay, so these are all some pharmaceutical agents that can be used for anticoagulation therapy. And does anybody know any other, maybe newer kinds of anticoagulants that actually will be probably a lot more useful in the future? And actually, we're starting to use them a little bit, but have you ever heard of the vampire bat? What does a vampire bat do? Don't have any in the United States. We're too far north, but Central America, South America has them. They're a bat. And they can fly around, and they'll land on cattle, and they'll bite into cattle, and they'll drink the cattle's blood as nourishment. Well, how is it that you can sit there and drink blood from somebody?
They have a venom.
Okay, they have to have something that retards coagulation, right? And so they produce an anticoagulant, and it's a natural anticoagulant. Probably it's going to be better than coumarin and heparin. I don't know the name of it. I should probably know the name of it. There is another animal that produces an anticoagulant that it uses for feeding as well. And that is, what? Do you know anybody? Mosquito, yeah, I don't know if they have an they might have an anticoagulant, okay, but leeches do, right? And I forgot the name of that chemical, okay? So that's just kind of a plug for biodiversity, trying to maintain biodiversity on a planet. It's important to protect, I think, all animal species, because you never know when you might need something as gross as a leech, because it might provide some really important clinical importance to us, right? Maybe like developing new anticoagulation therapy that's easier to adjust, has less side effects, for instance. Okay. Okay, pulmonary and systemic circulations. All right, so you just got to know this from your anatomy. Here are all your slides. Well, you know, here's your heart. You got a right side and a left side. Well, left side pumps blood to your systemic circulation. So make sure that you know where oxygen goes in, where carbon dioxide comes out, and what the right side of the heart does that pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation. And I could maybe just ask you a quick question. Which circulation is longer, pulmonary or systemic? Systemic, right, is a lot longer. So it requires a lot more energy to pump blood through that longer circuit compared to the shorter pulmonary. So what side of the heart is doing more work, the left or the right side? The left side has got to be doing a lot more work. And what happens to a muscle when you exercise it harder? It gets bigger, right? So the left ventricle is a lot thicker compared to the right ventricle. Okay, so yeah, just remember all of these parts right here. If you want me to go over some of this stuff, probably have to see me during office hours, for instance. Okay. All right, so I don't know if I'm going to talk about any of this. What kind of blood vessel takes blood away from the heart? An artery. What kind of blood vessel brings blood to the heart? Vein. And what kind of, can you ever have a vein that is deoxygenated? Yeah, and what would be a good example? The pulmonary vein. So here's a pulmonary vein bringing blood back from the lungs, right? And in the lungs, of course, CO2 goes out, oxygen comes in. So this is oxygenated blood in this pulmonary vein. Okay. What kind of blood vessel allows for exchange? Capillaries. Only capillaries, because other blood vessels are way too thick and diffusion can't occur through them, because probably you should know the different layers of a blood vessel, like the muscularis, right, and the serosa, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. All right, now here is something. Oh, I put it in a funny color right here. Probably I wanted to mention this to you, because this I don't think you pick up in an anatomy class. All right, so the heart is actually two pumps, kind of back to back. There's one pump that's pumping blood through what, the systemic circulation, and then there's another one right after it, the right side of the heart, that is pumping blood through the pulmonary circuit. All right, so they're back to back, or what we say, in series with each other. All right, so the left side of the heart won't be pumping any blood if, for instance, maybe the left side is just fine, but what happens if the right side of the heart stops pumping blood? What happens to the left side? Well, if the right side stops pumping blood through the lungs, there's no blood coming back to the left side to pump out. Okay? Or maybe not so drastically, if the right side isn't pumping as much as the left side, what does that mean? That means that blood is going to back up and get it pool someplace, right? So in order for the heart to work properly, right, the left side of the heart has to pump exactly the same amount of blood as the right side, because it's all flowing on the same streak, right? It's just two pumps back to back. So the rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation. So you got to kind of develop a little bit of an intuitive feel for that somehow or another, even if you have to come see me during office hours or ask me a couple questions. Okay. Now, it doesn't have to match up second by second, but maybe every 15 seconds or 20 seconds, right? It doesn't have to be instantaneous, but somewhere in a relatively short period of time, it has to even out, or else what? The lungs are going to blow up, they're going to fill up with blood, and then they're going to explode like a water balloon. That's not quite true, but that would be bad. Okay. Okay. Well, one thing I will mention, between the atria, which are by the base of the heart, and the ventricles, all right, there is fibrous tissue, connective tissue, all right, and this fibrous tissue is important because it anchors the valves in place, And it provides support for the heart. But also, it means that we don't have muscle tissue in this area right here. And muscle tissue can act like nervous tissue because it has voltage-gated channels on it, right? So action potentials can travel over muscle fibers. But this connective tissue blocks action potentials from freely going from the atria to the lower chambers. Right, so you have a lot of non-conductive tissue between the atria and the ventricles right here because of all that, the fibrous skeleton of the heart. All right, so that's going to be important when we start talking about electrical activity of the heart. All right, heart valves. All right, so this you got to know on your own too, just kind of a nice review. All right, you got two atrioventricular valves, tricuspid, bicuspid. Remember, just try before you buy. And then you have semilunar valves. Right, and remember all the little chorda tendineae on the AV valves and the papillary muscles, right? Okay, and what's the job of these valves right here? Do they play an important function?
Yeah.
Yeah, real important. What do?
Prevent backflow.
Yeah, they prevent what we call retrograde flow of blood. And so you could say backflow, but retrograde flow of blood. Now, why is that important? Okay, why is that really important? Well, I have sort of an analogy to you. Right, if blood is flowing from the right atrium into the right ventricle as it should, right, and then if this valve doesn't close and the right ventricle contracts, not only is blood going to go into the pulmonary trunk, blood is going to flow backwards into the atrium right here, right, which really defeats the purpose of the heart contracting. All right, so let's think of kind of a futile process that maybe you've tried at one point in time. Say you're going to walk up these stairs right here. Is it easier to walk up or walk down the stairs? It's a lot easier to walk down than to walk up. It takes some energy to walk up the stairs, right? Well, have you ever tried to walk up maybe a sand dune, some sand someplace? Okay, so what do you do when you're walking up a sand dune? You take a step up, and you step up there, and what happens? You slide back down, right? Not a whole step, otherwise you'd never make it to the top, but maybe two-thirds of the way down. And then what do? You take another step up, and what happens? You slide down. So how much energy does it take to walk up a sand dune even compared to a stairway? Oh, like more than twice the amount of energy, right? You're exhausted by the time you get up there. Same thing happens to the heart. So when there is an incompetent valve or a leaky valve, it's going to kill the heart because the heart just has to work so hard to maintain the proper flow that it's going to give out. Just like if you were going to run up a sand dune all day long, right, you couldn't do it. You could run up stairs maybe all day long, but not a sand dune. Okay. So that's really the importance of these valves right here, right? So it just relieves a lot of the work that the heart has to do. Okay. All right. So make sure you know all this anatomy pretty well. Okay, the cardiac cycle. All right. So this is something that we're going to cover in here. And maybe you know a lot about this stuff already. All right, the heart, it does not pump blood like an electric pump that's turning constantly and pumping, like maybe you have around the house if you have any fish tanks or whatever. The heart pumps blood, and then it relaxes for a little bit, and it fills up with blood, and then it contracts again, and when it contracts, it pumps blood. So we call that a reciprocating pump. At some point in time, it's filling with blood and not pumping, and then at another point in time, it's contracting and pumping blood. So the heart has two main phases associated with it, right? And so there's a contraction phase and a relaxation phase. The contraction phase is what we call systole. The relaxation phase is what we call diastole. And this is just a repeating pattern of contraction and relaxation over and over and over again. And for years and years and years, when people were interested in heart failure, guess what part of the heart cycle people were most interested in studying? Systole, the contraction phase, okay? But more recently, people are very interested in the diastolic function of the heart, and you might be wondering, well, why the heck is anybody interested in that, okay? And that is, the reason is, because in order for the heart to pump a lot of blood when it contracts, what has to happen to the heart when it relaxes? In order for the heart to pump blood, it's got to what? It's got to fill up with blood, okay? So that's one important reason. And in order for the heart to fill up, it's got to relax, right, and it's got to expand. And if it can't relax and expand, it might have proper systolic function. It might contract just as normal, but if there's no blood in there or not the proper amount of blood, then your blood pressure is going to go down, your cardiac output is going to go down, and you might not be able to survive. So you got to understand both of these functions right here and how they operate. Okay, so the heart, the way the heart contracts is coordinated. Both atria contract simultaneously, and then there's a short delay, and then both ventricles follow about a quarter of a second later. So first the atria contract, and then both ventricles contract. And that's sort of a little bit of a different story than what I've been telling you before, because for cardiac muscle, what have you learned about cardiac muscle in that how it's different compared to skeletal muscle? It has... Yeah, it contracts as a unit because of gap junctions, okay? Okay. But it doesn't, the atria and ventricles don't contract together because of the heart has a pacemaker that's up in the atrium, right? The right atrium. But remember, we said that in the last couple slides, we said that the atria are isolated electrically from the ventricles because of what's between them? The fibrous skeleton. That's right, the fibrous skeleton. So the atria really contract together as a unit, and then the atria control, under normal conditions, the contraction of the ventricles, and the ventricles contract as a unit because they are linked together by gap junctions. But the atria and the ventricles don't have gap junctions between them because of the fibrous capsule. And you're going to see why that's important in just a second. Okay, so normal systemic blood pressure is 120 over 80. And so why do you have these two numbers right here? And when I say systemic, do you know what I'm talking about? That's from the left side of the heart, right? Correct, I mean? All right, 120 over 80. Why do you have two numbers? Because you have systolic pressure, that's the peak pressure, and then before the heart contracts again, the pressure decreases, and 80 is diastolic pressure. So that's normal. What do we call it when somebody has a blood pressure of maybe 130 over 90? What do we call that? That is hypertension, right? And hypertension is just as deadly, okay? Well, it is deadly because why? The heart has to work harder. It's as almost as deadly as having a leaky valve. Right, so as you get older, this number elevates a little bit. There's not much we can do about that, but everybody should be shooting for this kind of blood pressure. And if you don't have 120 over 80, then you need to see a physician because it's very deadly. But it's kind of strange because you feel fine. You don't feel like there's anything wrong. Okay. Okay. What do we call it if your blood pressure is, say, 110 over 60? What is that called?
Hypotension.
That's hypotension, okay? And you're wondering, is that clinically relevant? Well, you know what? It's usually not, okay? The way you need blood pressure to move blood through your circulatory system, and if you change body position, for instance, from sitting down to standing up and you have hypotension, and your blood pressure is so low that you pass out as you stand up, that's a problem, right? Because you hit your head on the table and then the chair and then the floor, right? End up with a bunch of bruises, maybe a broken neck or something. So hypotension usually is not clinically important unless you pass out, right? We call that syncope. The nice thing about hypotension is the lower your blood pressure is, the less susceptible you are to cardiovascular disease, as long as what? It's not so low that you pass out, right? So as a matter of fact, if your blood pressure is 120 over 80, if you can get it to be lower than that by exercise or whatever means, that's even better. Right, as long as you're not driving down the freeway and passing out or something. So hypotension usually is protective, but not in all circumstances. Okay, so usually it's very good. But sometimes it's harder to measure when you have hypotension. Maybe you can't use these real simple auto-inflating cuffs to tell what it is because it doesn't fit the algorithms quite right. But if you feel fine and you have low blood pressure, you should be really happy. Okay. The higher your blood pressure is, right, there's no magic number. The higher your blood pressure is, then the higher the incidence of cardiovascular disease you might be prone to. Right? So the lower the better, the higher the worse it is. Okay, what about pulmonary blood pressure? Okay, sometimes it's kind of hard to tell what a good number for pulmonary blood pressure is, but it's about 25 over 10. And why is it so much less? Because the pulmonary circuit is so much shorter, it doesn't need the same amount of energy or force to push blood through the lungs compared to the rest of your systemic circulation?
How do they measure that?
Okay, that's a really good question. That is extremely hard to do, and that's why we don't really have a good idea of what that number is unless you want to reserve a surgical suite and do some surgery to find out. Okay, because let's see if I can find a picture. Here's a pretty good picture of the heart. Well, if you want to measure systemic circulation, so for instance, blood is coming out of the aorta and that blood is going to go down into your arm, right? So here you have a blood vessel in your arm, and you can put a pressure cup on your arm very easily and with sphygmomanometry figure out what your blood pressure is, because it's an external circuit. But if you want to measure pulmonary pressure, where do you have to put a transducer? Inside your chest, right? So it's really pretty much impossible to measure pulmonary pressure. And it's not that it's not as important. There is such thing as pulmonary hypertension, but it's kind of a hidden disease. It's very difficult to diagnose and understand, maybe with an echocardiogram. And maybe there's one technique that you used in lab. Did you do the mean electrical axis yet? Measurement? Okay. Maybe I'll talk about that sometime after you guys do it, actually. Well, let's see. Maybe I'll talk about it right now. Okay. Pulmonary hypertension means that the right side of the heart now has to develop a lot more pressure to get blood through the lungs. So what does that mean? Is the heart working the same, less, or more if it's developing more pressure, if you have pulmonary hypertension? So what happens to the right side of the heart if it's working harder? It's going to get bigger, right? All right, so it's going to get bigger and it's going to get stronger. And when muscles contract, they generate electrical activity, right? And if you measure electrical activity from a skeletal muscle, we call that an electromyogram. Maybe you did that in lab. And we can also measure electrical activity from the heart when it contracts, because there's depolarization and repolarization of the heart, and that's called what? An electrocardiogram. All right. And notice when the heart is normally situated in your body, is it nice and symmetrical in your body, right on midline? It starts on midline, but as you go from base to apex, it does what? It moves to the left. But also as you move from base to apex, it even goes more anterior. It's doubly angulated like that. Okay. So there's a certain angulation that the heart has, and you can measure that angle on an ECG if you do it properly, and you're going to do this in lab, right? And that angle is due to not only the angle of the heart, but in the normal heart, it's also due to having more muscle on the left compared to the right. But when you have pulmonary hypertension, the right chamber hypertrophies, and guess what happens to what we call the mean electrical axis of the heart? Because now you have more batteries and depolarization on the right side of the heart, it pulls the mean electrical axis to the right. All right, so you can kind of diagnose, at least I think you should be able to diagnose, all right, abnormalities of the right ventricle by looking at that mean electrical axis. And you get that from an ECG. And you get to do that in lab maybe next week or the week after or something like that, which is a lot better than trying to thread a catheter up from some leg someplace to get it into this pulmonary trunk right here to measure blood pressure. But basically, it's impossible to do easily. And so we don't talk about it very much. But if you have pulmonary hypertension on the right side, that will kill the heart just as much as if you have systemic hypertension. And we hardly even talk about hypertension as being systemic or pulmonary. But usually we're talking about what? Systemic hypertension. Okay. So I think maybe that's all I'll say about that for right now. So how would you measure that? Fantastic question. Because you can't get at those vessels very easy. You can't put like a pressure cuff around somebody's chest. That wouldn't work. Okay. Well, let's talk about some definitions with respect to the cardiac cycle. We have an end-diastolic volume. Okay, what does that mean? That is the volume of the heart, maybe in particular a ventricle, at what period of time? At the end of relaxation, or at the end of diastole. And what happens during diastole? What happens to the heart?
Rest.
It rests, but what else happens to it?
Fills.
It fills with blood, so when it's filling with blood, it expands, right? So end diastolic volume is really important. That's the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. And And systolic volume, I'm going to skip over this one right here for a second, and systolic volume is the amount of blood left in the ventricles at the end of contraction, right? So, and systolic volume is kind of nice to understand something about the systolic function of the heart. If it's pumping with enough vigor to pump blood out of the heart. But don't forget, if the heart is going to pump blood out, what has to happen during diastole? It's got to fill up, right? If it's not filling up, then systolic function is going to be reduced as well. All right, then this last term right here is called the stroke volume. The stroke volume is the amount of blood ejected from the ventricles during systole. All right, and that stroke volume is not 100% of the end diastolic volume. For instance, when the heart contracts, after systole, there's always going to be some blood left over in the ventricles. It can't pump 100% of the blood because it can't collapse completely. So that's what we call stroke volume. These are all measured in milliliters, and what the heck is a milliliter? What is that? Is that like a measure of voltage or tension, or is that flow, or what is that? That's volume, right? That's just a cubic centimeter, so that's volume. It's not a length, it's not a distance, it's volume, right? Okay, so here I got a couple questions for you. What's larger, end systolic volume? Oh, look, where was I when I made this slide? Okay. Yeah, they look pretty much the same. Okay, which is larger, end systolic volume or end diastolic volume? I was trying to be tricky, I guess. Which one is larger, end systolic or end diastolic? Diastolic, because that's when the heart is filled, right? And systolic, so you always think of systole, you always kind of latch on to systole as being important, but that's actually the smaller volume that's after contraction. All right, so here's a little homework problem for you. What is the stroke volume if the end systolic volume is 20 and the end diastolic volume is 80? And you can maybe do that right now in your mind if you wanted to. Okay, but know how to calculate stroke volume. It's what? It is end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. Okay, that would be the stroke volume. Okay. All right, so we're going to start looking at some cardiac function right now. So as the ventricles contract, the pressure in the blood in the ventricle starts to rise. All right, and, I wish I had a nice picture of a heart. What happens? How does blood flow? I guess I'm going to draw something. Let's draw a heart. Here's a heart. Okay. And then these are the, there's the RA, here's the, LA, and then this is the RV, and this is the LV right here, and here is an atrial ventricular valve right here. Okay. Now, how is any fluid going to move from one space to another? What has to happen to a fluid in order for it to move one way or another? Okay. So, yeah, in terms of, yeah, it can diffuse by osmosis. Okay. And you're thinking exactly along the lines I would like you to think. But the reason why a fluid will move is that it's going to move from an area of high pressure to low pressure. So there's got to be pressure. And so the whole job of the heart is to do what? To generate high pressure so that blood is going to flow through some kind of circulation. Okay? And the process is almost the same as concentration grade. There are pressures there as well. All right, so the right ventricle, and this artery is not going to go in the right place, but I'm going to put it down over here just for fun. This is what, the pulmonary trunk right here. And what do we got? We've got the pulmonary semilunar valve. So when the right ventricle contracts, right, blood is going to want to go from high pressure to low pressure back into the right atrium. But what happens? Yeah, the tricuspid valve closes. All right, now why did I start talking about this? Okay. But during diastole, what can you tell me about this pulmonary semilunar valve right here when the heart is relaxed? It's closed as well because we don't want blood going backwards from the pulmonary trunk into the right ventricle. So as soon as this ventricle contracts, this semilunar valve is closed, and as soon as the pressure is higher in the right ventricle compared to the right atrium, the tricuspid valve closed. So now you have both valves closed, and the heart is still contracting. But since blood isn't going anywhere, what's happening to the volume of the ventricle? It's actually staying the same. But what's happening to the pressure? Just like, for instance, my hand isn't changing shape, but I'm squeezing this marker harder and harder and harder and harder, right? But my hand isn't changing shape. So the same thing with this blood in here. The pressure is going up, but the volume of the heart, of the ventricle, isn't changing. We call that the period of isovolumetric contraction. Isovolumetric means that it's pressurizing, but these valves are closed, so the volume cannot change. Okay, then what happens? When the pressure inside a ventricle exceeds the pressure of this artery, what happens? That valve opens up, and now, okay, the heart contracts, it gets smaller, the volume decreases as blood is ejected into the artery right here. So that's no longer isovolumetric. All right, so that's isovolumetric contraction and ejection. All right, and then as the pressure in the ventricle falls below that of, well, the aorta or the pulmonary trunk, okay, so as the blood gets pumped out, the pressure starts to decrease in the ventricle, pressure is high in the artery, blood starts to flow back, what happens? The semilunar valves slam closed, okay? Okay. Okay, so all valves are closed, and then, right, because this valve is still closed, and this valve is closed, now the heart starts to relax, right, and then we call that isovolumetric relaxation, when both valves are relaxed. And when the pressure in the ventricles fall below the atrium here, what happens? Then you have high pressure here compared to the ventricles, and then the AV valves open, and the ventricles start to fill with blood. What happens to the volume of a ventricle as they fill with blood? Okay, then they start to expand and the volume gets bigger, okay, if it's a healthy heart. Okay. Okay, and then atrial systole starts, and that pumps an extra little squirt of blood into the ventricles. All right, so here is a nice graph that shows a number of cardiac events. All right, that I want you to appreciate. So whenever you start to look at a graph, what should you immediately look at? The axes of the graph, right? So that you know what to focus on. So what are we looking at here? We're looking at this bottom line. We're looking at heart sounds. So somebody has placed a stethoscope or a microscope on somebody, and you're actually listening to sounds coming from your chest. So this is sound versus time. We call that a phonocardiogram, all right? And I'm only going to talk about the first and second heart sound in here. And the second line is also versus time, but it is the electrocardiogram. So this is a measure of what? Voltage versus time. And did you do an electrocardiogram in lab yet? Anybody? Yeah? Okay. And so you have to put electrodes on your wrists and ankles in order to measure a voltage difference between those electrodes. All right, so this is the electrocardiogram. And then we also have a plot of volume versus the heart cycle or time. So here you can see the volume of a ventricle, and I presume this is the left ventricle right here, and you can see that it expands, right? And then as the heart contracts, the volume goes down. And then as the heart relaxes, the volume goes back up again. So this is volume. And then we have a number of graphs that are pressure versus time. All right, pressure in the ventricle, pressure in the aorta, and then pressure in the atrium right here. All right, so we want to look at these and see how they all correspond to each other. Okay. Well, let's look at the ECG first. And I think we talk about the ECG in this chapter, but I haven't talked about it yet, so I'm not going to go into a lot of great detail, but you see some what we call waveforms on the ECG. These are bumps. And here's the first one. And guess what we call the first one? Okay? That's like, I call that one like the primavera wave, right? Probably why it was named, right? The P wave. It's the first wave. All right, so here's the P wave. And then what letter comes after P? Q, right? So here's the QRS complex. And then the last one is the T wave. All right, so P, QRS, and T. Now, what we're looking at right here, can you see when the heart starts to contract? When does the heart start to contract? When the pressure changes inside the ventricle, which is what? This nice blue, is it blue?
Purple.
Okay. Yeah, the purple line right here is when the heart starts to contract. All right. Now, what happens first? Does the QRS complex happen first, or does the heart start to contract first? Does the electrical activity come first, or does it come after the heart starts to contract? Okay, that's right. So the ECG is really the signal for contraction of the heart. ECG is the electrical activity of the heart. It's not a physical measurement of what's happening inside. It's just a measure of electrical activity, and it's a signal for contraction. All right, so if you're sitting at a stoplight and all of a sudden the stoplight turns green, does that mean you're automatically through the intersection as soon as it turns green? No, you have to like take your foot off the brake, step on the gas pedal, and then you move through the intersection. The green is just a signal for you to proceed. So the QRS complex is just a signal for contraction, for initiation of contraction. It's not really contraction. Okay, so that's what you can see on this slide. What else can you see on this slide? Well, here is pressure in an atrium. Okay, and is it higher or lower than pressure in the ventricle? Right here where I have it. It's higher. So which way is blood flowing? Is it flowing from the atrium into a ventricle or from ventricle into an atrium? Yeah, because pressure of blood will always flow from high pressure to low. So blood is going to flow from the atrium into the ventricle because of this pressure difference. So what happens to the size of that ventricle as blood is flowing in? Look at the volume curve right here. It actually, what? Increases. Okay, so you can see how changes in volume of the heart, of the ventricle, correspond to pressure differences within the heart. All right, and then where do you see pressure in the ventricle higher than the atrium? Probably right where I have the cursor. This is where it crosses over. All right, so now you have higher pressure inside the ventricle because it's been signaled to contract, right? And what does blood want to do now if you have higher pressure in the ventricle compared to the atrium? It wants to flow back into the atrium. So what happens during that period of time? The AV valve's got to close, right? So as soon as the pressure is higher in the ventricle than the atrium, the AV valve closes, and guess what that produces? The first heart sound, okay? So that's closure of the AV valves right at the beginning of systole, when the ventricles start to contract. All right, but the semilunar valve is still closed because why? Where's the pressure in the aorta? Way up over here. All right, so in order for this aortic valve to open, what has to happen? The pressure in the ventricle has to be higher than the aorta. And where does that happen? Right here at this point in time. So that's why the aortic valve opens here, because we have higher pressure in the ventricle. This ejects blood into the aorta, and as blood is flowing into the aorta, look what happens to the pressure in the aorta. It goes up to a peak pressure, which we call systolic pressure, and then after the heart pumps, and so when the aortic valve opens, what happens to the blood inside the ventricle? It's flowing from the ventricle into the aorta, so what happens to the volume of the ventricle? It goes down. So you can see the volume curve right here. Okay, so during this period of time, when the AV valve is closed and the semilunar valve is closed, the volume of the ventricle can't change. Blood can't go anywhere, even though the heart is contracting and pressurizing the blood. This is what we call what? The isovolumetric contraction phase of the heart. All right, then after the heart has pumped blood, the pressure decreases. Right, and as the pressure in the heart decreases, then the aortic valve closes, and when the AV valve, when the aortic semilunar valve closes, guess what happens? The second heart sound. Okay. Okay, and then the ventricle is in diastole right here. Right, and then this little bump we see is due to contraction of the atria, pumps a little bit of blood into the ventricle, and this is due to ventricular systole. And then just this process happens over and over and over again. So you might notice this little notch right here. All right, in the pressure curve within the aorta, we call this the dicrotic notch, because it takes some energy for the aortic semilunar valve to close. And when the aortic semilunar valve closes, what happens? That valve actually goes backwards to close, and that reduces the pressure a little bit in the aorta. So that's always a very normal, kind of common thing to see on a pressure curve. So it's just not a flat line through here. You see that little deviation. Okay, so this is an important diagram for you to see your systemic blood pressure in the aorta. So what is the peak systolic pressure that we see in the aorta right here? Can you read that off the graph? What would it be? So here is a peak pressure in the aorta. Here it is right here. And if we look over, what is that? 120. And is that normal? Yeah, that's absolutely normal. And what is diastolic pressure? You see it right here, and that is 80. Right, so that is just your normal systolic pressure. That's the normal pressure that we would see in the aorta. And the pressure really doesn't change very much by the time it gets to the brachial artery. Okay, maybe it loses a couple millimeters of mercury, but not very much. And so we can measure systemic pressure in somebody's arm. All right, but what else do you see on this slide? How blood pressure in the ventricle goes from basically zero during diastole to, okay, very high, maybe over 120 to pump blood into the aorta. And then it goes back down to zero again. All right, and how the volume changes. So could you calculate stroke volume from this graph right here? Because where is end systolic volume? Where is end systolic volume? So here's volume of the ventricle. Where is end systolic volume? Is it here? What is systole? Contraction. And is end systolic volume a big volume or a little volume? It's the little one. So here is end systolic volume. Maybe that's about 50. All right. And then when the heart fills at the end of diastole, here is end diastolic volume. So the stroke volume would be what? 130. Basically looking at it on an angle, minus what? 50. That would be the stroke volume of the heart. Okay? And so I want you to become familiar with stroke volume, because in the next chapter we're going to be using that to understand a lot about blood pressure. Okay? So is that it for today? I guess that's about it. Oh yeah, so we talked about the heart sounds. So probably on Monday I'll finish up some of these heart murmurs right here and go into electrical activity of the heart. Okay. Now your lab book has an excellent cardiac cycle function diagram, but your textbook has a really lousy one. All right, so don't feel bad that I gave you this really good one, because you also have a really good one in your lab book. Okay, and it's going to correspond more to the one that I'm showing you here. I just couldn't get it scanned fast enough. Yeah. So the test is not going to, yeah, it's going to be Wednesday, but it's going to be over muscle and this first chapter on blood and the heart, but not blood pressure. So what is that, 12 and 13? 12 and 13. I got to get that done. Yeah. I got it on here. I'll put it on there really soon. Yeah, I'd be happy to.